This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
This is Patsy with a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book. Coming to you from glorious Clearwater, Florida, the perfect place for writers to write and readers to enjoy a good book. Check out my Facebook page, Radio Joy on Paper, and let me know if you have an author that you want me to invite on the program. Well, today I have a really fantastic guest and someone I admire so much. Because as everyone knows who listens to me, I love history, and he's a great historian. And the book that we're going to talk to him about, because there are so many books of his that I want to talk to him about, but we're going to talk today to Matthew Dennison about his book, Over the Hills and Far Away, The Life of Beatrix Potter. Hi, Matthew, are you there?
Good morning, Patsy.
Oh, good morning. How are you over there in England?
I'm very well, thank you. How are you?
Oh, it's so nice to talk to you. As I mentioned to you in my email, I lived in England for a long time, and I'm familiar with your area, and you are very, very lucky.
Indeed I am.
It's so beautiful. And, of course, there are so many of your books that I want to talk to you about, including, of course, your wonderful Queen Victoria books. But today I thought, because I had just spoken to Claiborne Hancock at Pegasus, and we were talking about this wonderful book that you've written, Over the Hills and Far Away, The Life of Beatrix Potter. So I thought we'd start with that one today.
Great.
It's a wonderful book.
That's very kind of you.
You've done such a beautiful job in telling this story about this marvelous woman who has really, whoa, I mean, she was so important in my life. I just like so many children in the world, she was one of the first books that I read. So tell us about Beatrix Potter.
For me, she's a genuinely inspiring figure. And I think it's because she's both a typical but atypical Victorian woman. So her protests are the protests made by many 19th century women who feel their lives so restricted by so many societal assumptions, but at the same time she has that ballsiness that I think of as being part of the best Victorian women, a determination to sort of escape what's assumed for her and become the person that she wants to become. And interestingly, as we find out more about her life, what emerges is that she wasn't quite sure the person she wanted to become. She just knew she didn't want to be like her mother.
Okay. So
I also feel that the truth is that people all over the world have been touched by what Potter called her little books, the stories of anthropomorphic animals. And there's a reason why every minute of every hour of every day of the year, somebody buys one of these books by Beatrix Potter. They have such an enduring magic. And there is a genius behind that, the fact that she integrated stories and pictures and continues to touch people and wrote fictions more than 100 years ago that are oddly undated. They don't have the kind of sexist, racist, classist assumptions of so much children's literature of its time.
Well, I think for most children in America, and of course in England and all over the world, among our first words are Flopsy, Mopsy, Cottontail, and Peter.
And then Soporific.
Yes. And of course, farmer. You know, I was raised in northern Michigan, and of course my grandparents had farm, and I remember always we lived actually a life like that. We were on the farm. We had the rabbits running around like crazy. I fed the chickens. It was really a wonderful life, and to read these stories and to look at those marvelous pictures, just amazing.
Yes, because they retain a wonderful freshness, don't they?
They are. They're as fresh today as when she did them, and they are as correct. I mean, for a farm girl, that's what our farm looked like, you know?
Yes.
So it's such a reality for me.
Yes. I think part of her skill is that the pictures seem fanciful to us. The idea of a rabbit wearing clothes seems fanciful and fantasist. But, of course, it was based on really close observation, and she worked immensely hard. In a way, she gave herself the kind of artistic training that if you wanted to be an Olympic runner, you would give yourself as a runner, day after day after day of practicing, drawing over and over again, observing closely, having rabbits as pets, living with them beside her. Because, of course, an extraordinary fact about Potter's life is that until she got married at the age of 47, she lived in the nursery on the third floor of her parents' house, essentially with no friends once her brother had left home, but with her own private menagerie of little animals.
And it was so funny. At the age of 47, her parents still didn't approve of her choice.
Still disapproved, and she still continued to look after them following her marriage.
It's hard still to understand that. But, you know, she was so wonderful. Of course, her art was so great. And in a way, she had this scientific side of her where she did really serious work in botany. And yes. In a way, we're sort of lucky that they didn't, you know, pull her into the universities or turn her into a botanist, because I'm not sure if she'd have written these delightful little books if she had.
Yes, I think you're absolutely right. If British society had been more accepting of the idea of a female scientist, and particularly specifically a female botanist at that point, then she wouldn't have been deflected from her love of fungus and probably would never actually have got on with writing these books.
Because her scientific art is spectacular. You look at it and you think, wow, she has to be among the best artists for scientific material that I've ever seen.
Yes, if any of your listeners were ever to go to the Victoria and Albert Museum in London, for example, and look at the drawings that Potter made under a microscope of butterfly wings and the tiny, tiny fragments of colour, they're so precise and yet so beautiful.
But of course, in those days, they sort of scoffed at her and said, "Oh, she's a girl. We're not taking her seriously." And in the end, we're all the winners out of that.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Now, how did you? Well, first of all, what prompted you to write the book? Because you had, of course, you're a great historian. Your books, both about Victoria and about her youngest daughter, you know, are just amazing. And how did you decide on writing a book about Beatrix Potter?
Well, I have an interest in these would-be empowered 19th century female figures. I'd also reread the stories to my son when he was little, having had them myself as a child. I was very lucky until recently in that I lived very close to one of the houses where Potter spent time, certainly in her 20s. And it seemed to me that obviously initially the contract arose because there was a chronological hook. It was the 150th anniversary of Potter's birth, which means that publishers sit up and take an interest again. But beyond that, I thought there was a bigger question of explaining the kind of enduring appeal of what this woman did. But also of somehow exploring the disconnect between what most people take to be the coziness, almost the cutesiness of the stories, and actually this very redoubtable, unsentimental woman behind them. And of course, the truth is that the more one explores, the more it becomes very obvious that actually there is nothing sentimental about the stories either, that little sort of bit of steel in Potter's character actually flows through these sometimes rather tough stories.
Now, when she first went to have them published, initially she published them her first book herself, right?
Yes, that's right, yes. So but, Peter Rabbit and the Tailor of Gloucester, she published herself.
But how did it catch on right away?
Yes, she was very lucky in that the Tale of Peter Rabbit was privately published by Potter, but it managed to attract some big-name buyers, including Arthur Conan Doyle, obviously the author of the Sherlock Holmes stories. And at that point, Frederick Warne, the publishers, who had previously been fairly dismissive, suddenly paid attention to this, because I think essentially here we had a young, unmarried woman who wanted to write stories about rabbits. And that simply reinforced every kind of negative stereotype that a male Victorian publisher might have about a female would-be author. But when somebody like Conan Doyle, who of course is a bestseller and a figure of some repute, says, actually, this is rather terrific, at that point, this kind of male publishing fraternity do think, okay, it's time to look again at this. And of course, what had happened is that Potter had taken the risk herself. She'd put her money on the line, proved that it was a good business venture. So there was no risk, really, to the publisher at that point.
One of the original indie-published authors.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Now, of course, she was also a very clever businesswoman because she understood the concept of merchandising.
Yes, very early on indeed. Yeah, she was absolutely determined that she would retain control of what she called the sideshows, so all the sort of merchandising spin-offs. And she made the first Peter Rabbit doll. She made a Peter Rabbit board game. She oversaw the design of everything from slippers to hankies to writing paper to dolls, china tea sets. And in that way, she was very ahead of her time and certainly very ahead of thinking in Britain. I suspect that American authors were probably far ahead of British authors at that time. But for Potter to do that herself was remarkable.
Well, other than somebody like Frances Hodgson Burnett, who, of course, did Little Lord Fauntleroy and The Little Princess, she was also very clever in protecting her rights and protecting her characters.
Mm.
The two women are both, you know, very savvy businesswomen.
Yes, yes. Potter, as it happens, was let down by her publisher, who initially failed to copyright her characters in the United States.
And that happened to Burnett in the other way. She was copyrighted in America, not in England, and so she had to do a lawsuit in England that she won. And that changed copyright law in England forever because of that. Exactly. Now, when you know, you were doing the research, you went around to, of course, where she wrote her.
Yep.
And she was a fantastic conservationist. She really understood the importance of protecting the environment. And tell us a little bit about that, because I think that's fascinating what she did.
Yes, it's interesting. So Potter grew up in London, in the bit of London that nowadays we call South Kensington, which was only really emerging as part of London at the time. It was a new area of London, and much of it wasn't built upon, and there were still fields and orchards and such like. But by the time Potter was able to take notice, essentially she was in a rather swanky bit of London, and the country that she experienced were the botanical gardens and trips to cousins who had a farm in Putney, which is in South London, or to her grandparents who had a house in Hertfordshire. The garden of that house had been designed by Capability Brown in the 18th century, and so was an exercise really in English country perfected, but ultimately an artificial piece of landscape sculpting. So Potter's first engagements with the country had this rosy tint. They weren't really what a lot of English countryside looked at. Potter herself felt a kind of yearning for a sort of ancestral rootedness, which she found in the northwest of England. And obviously her books made considerable amounts of money. She came from a wealthy family anyway. She was ultimately able to buy land in the northwest of England. But when she came to settle there, it seems to me that she saw it through this prism of perfected country, the way she'd first encountered the landscape. And what she wanted to do was protect it in that perfect state as much as she could. And she had a real feeling for traditional building styles, vernacular styles, for traditional methods of farming. And she recognized that because farming never provided her main source of income, she could afford to farm in a way that was kind to the land and kind to the buildings on the land. And she made that an absolute mission of the second part of her life, and ultimately bequeathed to the National Trust, which is a big landscape conservation body in England, 4,000 acres, many farms and many buildings.
What a treasure.
Yes.
And because she was so forward-thinking to understand the importance of preservation, it is a wonderful testimony to her intelligence, I tell.
Yes, and to see the fragility of landscape in the face of what many people would consider progress shows her also somebody who, you know, thought outside the box.
Well, I do appreciate when people think about preserving places, because I, as I mentioned to you, I lived in Sanning, which is near, you know, Henley. And yes. I the reason I bought a cottage there, as a matter of fact, it was called St. Anne's Cottage. I bought it because it was 400 years old. And the lovely thing about Sanning is that they don't allow construction of new buildings. And so when you drive down the high street, other than they don't have the sweet shop there anymore. But other than that, you know, it's still the high street. And it's so delightful when you have those English villages that are preserved.
Yes, yes, because there is a real charm about English country building at its best.
Oh, it is. Well, Sanning is delightful. You just walk around and you just so enjoy the church and, of course, three pubs. I mean, that's it. Yes. That's the essential thing in a little English village, three pubs.
And, of course, Beatrix Potter had a pub right behind her house.
Well, you have to have that. But, you know, and that's being lost so much with all, well, yes, all the Milton Keynes as we know them.
Yes.
And the first time I went into Milton Keynes, which I'll tell everybody here, is that it's a, I think it was supposed to be a takeoff of an American development. And they built everything around circles. It's the most confusing place you can ever drive. But it doesn't have any of the charm that a proper English village has.
Yes, it was built at a bad time in British building, I think.
Very, very bad. So, of course, tell people where you are right now.
I live somewhere called Montgomeryshire, which officially no longer exists as a county, which is on the border of England and Wales, towards the top of Wales. And so I live in rather broad valleys of quite shallow, bosomy mountains, really very green, quite remote by British standards, and very beautiful indeed.
And very grateful that it is remote so people don't come and bother you too much.
Yes.
Because it is so beautiful over there. And
yes,
we hope
a
that...
a very good place to write.
Yes, that's what I was going to say. We hope that nobody's going to come and build a Milton Keynes over there. Please, yes, buy up the land and donate it to the National Trust. That's all I can tell everybody. Now, of course, you are a fantastic historian, and all of your writing is wonderful. And I, you know, just want to touch a little bit on Victoria, Queen Victoria, because you, of course, now you really done such in-depth research on Queen Victoria. And obviously there's a great deal of interest in her life. Tell us a little bit about why Queen Victoria drew you in.
I mean, Queen Victoria obviously has a sort of giant stature in British history and still British fairly recent history. And a little bit like Elizabeth I, she is associated with a period of expansion in British life, greatness in British life, a kind of golden age, if you like. And Victoria, what is interesting about Victoria is that she is the ultimate Victorian. Obviously, she gives her name to the era, but in British history, monarchs always give their name to an era. It doesn't necessarily mean that the era bears the stamp of their character. But in Victoria's case, it absolutely did. And what was very clever about her as a constitutional monarch who obviously had limited political power was that she was in touch with the feelings of a large percentage of the nation. So it meant that at a time when the monarchy had been in crisis before Victoria came to the throne, when the monarchy had been not held in great respect, when the children of George III had been mostly pretty disreputable, Victoria could be somebody with whom her countrymen could associate. So part of her attraction is that she is so successful at steadying the ship of state and actually stabilizing this institution of monarchy. One of the things I find fascinating, though, is the discrepancy between an almost hagiographical regard for Victoria held by many of her countrymen at the time, and actually what she was really like. And yet, in a way, that's too cruel. There were aspects of Victoria which were really dreadful, and in many ways she really was not a very likable woman. And yet there are other aspects of her which suggest immense charm and great humility and modesty and enormous diligence and determination to be the best queen she could, whilst always feeling she wasn't quite up to the job. I think another factor at the moment for us in Britain is that as our own queen reigns longer and longer, and of course a couple of years ago she surpassed Queen Victoria's record to become the longest reigning monarch in British history, we inevitably draw parallels between these two very long-lived, long-reigning women. And it seems to me they both gain by the comparison and the connection.
Well, both of your books, The Last Princess, of course, and and of course, your Queen Victoria book, are just wonderful. And
that's very kind. Thank you.
I want to tell people, if they really want to get into British history, those are two great places to jump in, because, as you say, Victoria put a stamp on her era, but it also, you bring in the history of England into the stories, and it's fascinating.
Mm.
So,
and if anybody ever hankers for historical research, I promise you, nothing could be nicer than to sit in a big round tower at Windsor Castle on a spring day, looking out over a moat full of daffodils, reading Queen Victoria's letters.
Ah, it is heaven. That sounds heaven. Well, now, did you ever do research in the British Museum reading room, the round one?
Yes, and the Bodleian Library in Oxford, which is also in the Sheldonian Theatre, which is also circular, and then the London Library itself, which is a wonderfully dusty sort of place full of creaky corridors. So we're lucky here. We've got lots of...
I spent many, many happy hours in the British Museum reading room, and in the days when they let you. Now they have it behind glass, which I think is absolutely disgusting.
Well, it's become an installation, really, hasn't it? It's a shame that the physical connection is lost.
It's completely lost. I don't know why they did it. I think that was one of the most delightful places. I could sit there for hours, and people don't understand if you had never done it, where you can just sit there and order books, and they bring them to you, and you're sitting in the chairs where all these famous people over the years sat.
It's reading just, the books that once belonged to George III.
Exactly. It made you feel so very, it was thrilling. And it is so sad. When I went back, last time I went there and I saw that glass, I really wanted to smash it. You might have had to write a story about me in the Telegraph. Crazy American breaks down the glass wall here. Why they did it? It just broke my heart to see it.
Wonderful.
Yes. Well, those wonderful opportunities in England to do research are sometimes.
But I had very happy. I spent happy winter days researching in Bloomington, Indiana, when I wrote my biography of Vita Sackville West, because the university there has all of her papers.
Well,
and as the snow fell outside in those beautiful buildings, that was terrific too.
Research is so much of the fun of being a writer, especially, well, of course, for a historical writer, it's just the joy. It's half the joy is doing the research.
Yes.
It's just fills your life, doesn't it?
Yes, I think for me, the Hercule Poirot aspect of biography, the finding out and the hoping that you will be able to put flesh on a skeleton, and the endlessly looking for that eureka moment, that little clue when everything falls into place, is really exciting. And then the challenge is to try and turn that into something that is both illuminating and hopefully beautiful and enjoyable to read.
Well, you certainly do. Your writing is of course, exquisite, because there are many historians, but few have a way with words the way that you do. And I always enjoy reading your work. And I'm just wanted to all my listeners that all they have to do is look up Matthew Dennison on wherever books are sold, Amazon and Barnes & Noble, and they can start with the Beatrix Potter, because I, as you say, I think she is inspiring. Her stories and her life are inspiring to all of us. And then they can go on to the Queen Victoria, and then they can do some Bloomsbury. And
yes.
there's a lot of stuff. And I hope that you'll come back, because I didn't book you for the whole hour because I wasn't sure of the connection. But now that we see that the connection from there, from where you are in this beautiful area of England, is just perfect because we hear you perfectly, I hope you'll come back again.
That's very kind. I'd love to do that.
Okay. Thank you so much, Matthew Dennison, for being on Joy
Thank
on Paper.
Thank you very much.
I appreciate it. Bye-bye now.
Goodbye.
Wow. Oh, if you could only be, if we could all be over there today, it is one of the most glorious areas of England. The kind of England that you dream about, and the green grass and the wonderful fields, it's amazing. So I was happy that the connection came through. Now we're going to have a quick commercial, then I'm coming back, and I have a really interesting author coming up.
This is the Tan Talk Radio Network.
Hello, I'm Mike Lindell, the inventor of My Pillow, and like all of you out there, I had problems sleeping. Pillows would go flat, I would flip-flop all night long, I would wake up with a sore neck, maybe a headache, or feel like I needed a nap even though I slept 8 hours. When I invented My Pillow, I wanted it to where you could move the patented fill to give you the exact support you need as an individual, regardless of sleep position. My Pillow will get you into that deep sleep faster, and you will stay there longer. It's not about how much time we spend in bed, it's about how much of that quality sleep we get. I do all of my own manufacturing right here in the United States. I have a 10-year warranty. You can wash and dry My Pillow, and I give you a 60-day money-back guarantee, so you have nothing to lose.
Mike is offering 50% off his 4-pack special.
Go to MyPillow.com or call 1-800-871-1543 and use the promo code PATSY, and Mike will offer you free shipping. Once again, that's 800-871-1543, promo code PATSY, P-A-T-Z-I. Are you an author, an artist, an inventor? Then you need to protect your valuable intellectual property. You need Larson & Larson. We have the experience and knowledge to help you with all of your legal needs, from processing trademark, copyright, or patent applications, to negotiating licensing agreements and handling litigation. The attorneys at Larson & Larson in Largo, Florida, can help protect you. Call us today for a no-cost consultation at 727-546-0660 or visit our website at larsonpatentlaw.com.
This is the Tan Talk Radio Network.
This is Patsy with a Z, and I am back with my next guest, Anne Z. Leventhal, who has written a book called Among the Survivors. It just came out this week, and I am very happy to have her on the program today. Hi, Anne, are you there?
I'm so happy to be here with you.
Well, you know, Anne, I am not Johnny Carson, but, okay, I know that in your dreams you wish that Johnny Carson would have interviewed you, but since he's not around, you have to be with me, okay?
I will make do.
Okay, I should have had Big Ed in the control room come on and say, and here's Patsy with a Z. Anyway, it's so nice to welcome you to the program today.
Thank you.
Well, you are quite an amazing woman. You know, the new book, which is your second book, right?
Yes.
Among the Survivors just came out. And it's been like a few years between books.
It has indeed. Well, I've been writing other things.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. You've been busy writing, but this it took a few years here. I think the first book came out in 1987, and it is not on Kindle.
No, it is not.
I couldn't.
In fact, it's out of print.
It's completely out of print.
Right.
I ordered one of the used ones, but it didn't arrive in time for me to read it. So you have to get it into Kindle.
I will try.
That's it.
Yeah.
So this is exciting for you. As you said, it's a wonderful book.
Thank you.
And I think that tell us a little bit about the story so my listeners can...
I will tell you about the story, but I will tell you also that it has been a struggle. I've been working on this book so long that I think it ought to be War and Peace, which it is not. It is about a woman who grows up with a single mother. She never knew her father. The mother dies when the kid is 16, after which she meets her father's parents for the first time. She discovers that her mother has filled her with lies, that her mother, who always claimed to be a Jewish Holocaust survivor, complete with tattoos on her arms, is in fact not a survivor, is not Jewish. She is a fake. And this, of course, leaves the daughter stunned. And the mother is not there to defend herself or to explain herself. And the daughter has to make do with finding out who she is and what the truth is. She feels like a nothing. The mother was, in fact, a Catholic, but since the daughter was not raised Catholic and was never baptized, she's essentially a nothing.
So this is a story about a young girl. She's 21 years old when the book opens, and
she, that's right.
Her name is Carla Most. And
exactly.
She is completely confused about who in the heck she is.
Right.
So
right. She just thinks there's something very wrong with her.
And, well, there was something very wrong with her mother, too, because I will say that this idea of dressing the child in black was interesting.
Yes. In one earlier draft, the book began with her birth, in which the cousin helps the mother to give birth at home and is horrified to find that the mother is dressing this newborn infant all in black.
Now,
but other people were not as interested in the details of birth as I was,
so
I moved along. Where Carla meets her love interest.
Now the cover is very interesting. It's a very evocative picture. And I'm holding it up to the camera because we have a podcast here, so people can see it.
Great.
And it's a beautifully done cover.
I love it too. And of course, that picture figures very heavily in the book.
Exactly. It's a part of the whole story. So as
right.
you said, you've been working on this for a while.
Right. I did a one version where I called it a memo, which was part memoir, part novel, and it had footnotes.
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I think this version is better.
I think probably it is.
I think so, too. Now, of course, you know, it's always fun when a book comes out, and as the as a former president of St. Petersburg chapter of Hadassah,
uh-huh.
I have a feeling that this book is going to do very well because I think they're going to pick it. All the Hadassah book clubs are going to pick it up.
I certainly hope so. From your mouth to God's ear.
Well, I think they will because it's fascinating. There's a story here that is both Jewish and also there's a love story and some really strange things happening too. And I think it's exactly a perfect book club book.
I agree with you. I actually think so, too.
So I'm sure.
And I am interested in the dilemma she has, because Carla, because she was raised to think of herself as Jewish. She has always thought of herself as Jewish. Well, technically, she isn't, because her mother is not Jewish. And the definition of a Jew, according to many Jewish religious leaders and the state of Israel, is... you are a Jew if your mother is Jewish, but you're not if you're not.
So she has a problem here.
She's got a real problem,
and she's got to figure it out. And we get to figure it out along with her.
Right.
And it, as I said, it is also a love story.
Yes.
And very, very intriguing. And you have developed a nice array of characters around her.
Thank you.
So. When you, as you said, you've gone through drafts and over the years, and then finally you got to a point where you were ready to have it published. And I see that it was published by She Writes Press.
Yes,
which is a very up and coming publishing arm that...
It's what they call a hybrid press. It's an interesting arrangement. It is not self-publishing in the standard way that you just print copies of what you want. It does filter. It only accepts books that it likes. But the writers pay for the editing and some of the production costs.
But they also do help promote the book, which is important.
Oh, absolutely.
And they are getting quite a solid reputation that the
books they pick win awards. I was very pleased to read some of those books, one by a woman named Sandy Berger and another one by a woman named Susan Winkler, both of which I thought were, I was proud to be published by the same publisher as they were. And the editor that they assigned me to, a woman named Annie Tucker, we did it entirely by phone. She was in California, I was in Florida, was terrific, absolutely terrific, a very serious, good editor.
Well, the book is well edited.
I think so.
I mean, it's top-notch, and as I said, She Writes Press has a great reputation, and they are bringing out so many wonderful female writers, and the support they give them, and the encouragement they give them, and then getting things like awards and getting you into book clubs, that's a big deal.
Yes.
And yes. Important.
And they've been very good at advice.
And
you know, what to do and how to do it. My first book, nobody did that for me, and it was, people liked it, a few people liked it, but it came and went.
Exactly.
And it had a great premise. It was about a woman who ran away with her husband's mistress. So that was fun.
Well, it sounds like fun. I'm looking forward to reading it when it arrives. Because I got the most expensive version of it, the collector's edition. So
Wow.
So I'm looking forward to getting that. Now, when you were working on this, so you did a lot of editing yourself over the years on this book.
Oh, yes, it's had many drafts.
Many drafts. Mm-hmm. And at which point, I mean, what finally you convinced you this is, it's ready to go?
Well, starting it in the middle, which is where it now starts, you just get to a point where you feel, I've now done everything I can. I felt it was a book I would have enjoyed reading if I picked it up. And that was the best I was going to do. It was not going to be War and Peace, much as I would have liked to have written War and Peace. It just wasn't. It's not in me. But this is the best book that is in me about Carla Most.
Well, I think you've done a terrific job. And you know, sometimes it comes a little bit later in our life than we want. But I think you have success here with this book.
Thanks so much.
And I'm sure that they're going to, you and they have to enter it into different awards, and it's going to win because the writing is great, and
Thank you. And
I think the premise is fascinating. I wasn't when your publicist first contacted me, I thought, whoa, what is that book? You know, when I got it, I started reading. I kept saying, wow, yeah, that is fascinating idea, and. And you certainly...
Well, for me, just to have a publicist is very exciting.
Yeah.
I've never done anything like this. I'm in all new territory, and talking to you is marvelous.
Well,
I love it.
Well, I'm happy to talk to you because I love to talk to authors who don't give up. I mean, that's part of what I try to do. I encourage writers to keep writing.
Absolutely. Well, I got to a point in my own writing. I've been writing for years, and I've been published in a lot of places. Some mostly magazines nobody's ever heard of, but some you have heard of. People have heard of the New York Times Book Review, and people have heard of Publishers Weekly, and people have heard of the Mississippi Review. So, you know, there is that. But mainly, you've not heard of you haven't heard of MeanAd or Passages North or Prairie Schooner, many of the other places where I have been published. But I came to a point in my writing where I realized that even if I knew for a fact that I would never be published, I would keep doing it. That it was very important to me to write, that it was very important to me to put what I'm thinking down on a piece of paper, because until I did that, I thought I was thinking one thing, and then it turned out there was more going on. So it helps me.
Well, now, are you continuing to write? Are you working on a new book?
I'm not working on a new book at the moment. I'm mainly pushing this one, but I write every day. I write something every day.
Of course.
I write articles. I write poetry. I write letters. I'm an old-fashioned snail mail letter writer, not to mention email, my God.
And, of course, you could write your own love story.
I could.
I believe that somebody already got sort of jumped
beat
the gun.
Beat me to it.
Beat you to it and wrote an actual play about you.
She did indeed. Janice Schaefer wrote Managing Maxine, which was done at the Oslo Theater, among other places, and which is a lot of fun. And I must also tell you that she took three things from my life. She took the fact that I am a writer and my second husband is a judge, a federal judge. She took the fact that we got together because I wrote him a letter. And she took the fact that his daughter was not thrilled with this arrangement. And she wrote the play about that. But the new fact about him is that he has also written a book. It was published about a week before mine. He has written a memoir called Benched, which is a lot of fun.
Oh, you didn't tell me that in your emails. You had to tell me these things. I need to know these.
Oh, let me read you the subtitle because it's good. It's called Benched, Abortion, Terrorists, Drones, Crooks, Supreme Court, Kennedy, Nixon, Demi Moore, and Other Tales from the Life of a Federal Judge.
Oh, wow. What a title. Oh,
yes.
Wow. Well, he has to come on one day.
Oh, that would be good.
Wow, wouldn't that be good?
Yeah.
I'll have to just give him time so that he can just say the title. That alone takes 5 minutes. Wow.
Right.
That's quite a title. Well, and it, of course, it is beautiful that a second love came to you late in life, and a second book came to you late in life.
Right. It's at the moment, it's being a golden age.
And it shows that you can never give up hope, and you can never stop trying, because you never know what life is going to bring you, right?
You don't, both the good and the bad. And when it's good, you should squeeze every drop of it as you can. I believe in having fun when possible.
Well, that's the best attitude. And as I tell the people who contact me, and they say, well, I have a book in me. I think I have a book in me. And I say, well, if you don't put it down on paper, nobody's ever going to see it. And at least...
Right, or at least speak it into a... If you can't put it down on paper, speak it into a tape recorder.
That's right, because it is wonderful to be able to preserve the memories, even if it's just your own family memories of your family.
Absolutely. I regret that I did not cause my mother to do this. I mean, she when she died, she took with her information that I wish I had, that she told me, but it didn't stick. For example, we had a relative who won a silver medal in the Olympics many years ago, and his name was Abel Kiviat. He was a runner, and he carried the torch when they were in Los Angeles. He was then in his 80s, I think, or maybe even 90s. Well, I don't know exactly how I'm related to. I know I am. There's somebody named Anna Kiviat who was in my family. My mother would have told me. I figured one of my cousins would tell me. None of us knows. We know we're related to that person, but we don't know exactly how.
Well, so that's why it's a good idea for everybody out there to just get it down on paper or tape it. And,
yes.
And you never know. You might turn it into a book. And
yes.
Just the joy of being able to see it and hold it as a book, and I'm
and
sure
to pass it on.
Exactly, to pass
everybody
it on.
Everybody knows things that are useful.
Now, with your book, are you doing a book tour?
Well, I hope to.
Yeah?
I hope to. I'm starting off with doing some signings in we're snowbirds, so we're in New York at the moment, and I'm doing one, and I'm actually doing two with my husband and his book and mine, and one on my own, and I hope to arrange things when I'm in Florida. And I'd also like to get to Seattle in particular, and maybe San Francisco, and we'll see.
Well, I think all you have to do is hook yourself up with Hadassah, and and they will help you.
I'm a Hadassah member,
I was going to say I'm sure that you are a Hadassah member.
Yeah.
And they have to do a review in their magazine. That's the first thing that you need to do.
I think they've been sent a copy.
And they have to do a nice review. And then you have to just put a little ad in there and start doing that. And that can be just a wonderful, when you tour the Hadassah book clubs, you know, sometimes, of course, most of the times we don't have the author. But boy, when we would get an author, we would get so excited.
Uh-huh. I love to talk to people. And there's something called the Jewish Book Council. I'm trying to work through them.
Well, that's a good idea. And now on your website, tell us your website, because you have little videos there that I think are nice.
I do. My website is annzleventhal.com. And my little videos I'm calling talklets, like to rhyme with chocolates. And I'm having a lot of fun with those. I've done three so far. They're about 2.5 minutes long, and the three are, start with, the first one is, I think people ask children all the time, what do you want to be when you grow old? And I think you should be people who have no interest in old people, but I want to answer the question of what do you want to be when you grow dead? So that's the first one. I discuss that, and the fact that I insist on being noticed even if I'm old. My second one is about my name and what's in it and what it implies. My third one is about learning and whether it's too late. And the fourth one, which I have not yet made but which I'm planning to make this weekend, is going to be about sex.
Oh, okay. Well, people have something to look forward to. So they can go to your website, which,
yes,
again, is Ann Z.
Leventhal, LEVENTHAL.com. I'm not sure these talklets are up on the website yet.
Yeah, they are. I heard them.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
Oh, good.
That's how I know you wanted Johnny Carson to.
Right.
So yeah.
I knew you knew that, but I thought maybe you got it from YouTube.
No, they come up very nicely. They
good.
It's
good.
A great website.
Good.
And the interview comes, you know, your little talklets come right up there, and it's very, very
great.
Interesting. I liked it. So I thought that was also very clever. And
I'm having a lot of fun with him. And my husband, although he's not getting any kind of recognition for it at all, is the tech guy. He's the cameraman.
Ah, okay. Well, he did a good job because you look beautiful in all of them.
Thank you. Thank you.
They're really great. And I just think that it's also a wonderful tool, because when you do contact all these book clubs, they will enjoy having those little things to promote when they promote you. So, yeah, it's wonderful. It's, you know, when you write a book, there's so many things involved.
This is the sort of thing you have to do if you want to get out there.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's the new way. You have to not only write your book, you have to find somebody who will help you publish it. And
yes.
Then, of course, you need to build this platform. And I think those talklets are cute. And I'm going to recommend that other authors look at your page, because it is a clever idea, and not too many authors have done it, and it works.
Thank you.
So, again.
Thank you.
It's never too late to learn something, right?
You're now, such a good boost for my ego, I must say.
Well, I think your writing is solid, the story is interesting. I love your little talklets, because right there one can see your enthusiasm and the joy that you found in life. And that you want to share it with people. And
thank you.
So I wish you the best of luck with this book. I'm sure it's going to win awards, and it's just a matter of getting it out there. And you have to do it every day too. You know,
yes.
One thing about publicity and promotion. It's nice to have a girl behind you, the girl sending out the publicity things, and. That's wonderful, but in the end, it all comes down to you, and you have to do so much of the work. But as long as you enjoy it, and you obviously do, and have the good spirit behind it, then it's not work. It's fun.
It is fun. It does take time, and like the book, when I got to a point where I realized I'd done enough, I'm sure I will get to that point with the publicizing as well. But at the moment, it's just sheer fun, and you have certainly contributed to that.
Well, thank you, and I hope that when you come down to Florida next time, you come here. I'm in Clearwater, Florida. Our studio's here in Clearwater, Florida.
I would love to do that.
Glorious Clearwater, Florida. And you bring in your husband, John O. Newman.
And that very one.
And he can tell us the title of his book, which is very interesting.
Right.
And you can be right here in the studio with me, okay?
I would love to do that.
Okay. So you let
Thanks
me know
so much.
When you're going to be in Florida and you'll come down here, okay?
I will do that.
Okay. And meanwhile, I want to thank you so much for being on the program today, Anne. It was wonderful to talk to you.
And vice versa.
Okay. Bye now.
Bye-bye.
Okay. Well, see? Anne is 81 years old, or almost 82 years old. It's going to be her birthday. And she never gave up. And her book is published. It's a very beautiful book. Lovely cover. They've done a great job of publishing. And it's an interesting story, and I think you will find it interesting. And she is an example of never giving up. So I just want to thank everybody for joining me today. Remember, one of the joys of life is to see your words on paper or hear them spoken on stage or screen or an audible version. And I am going to be having several narrators coming on the program in September, because I have just recently found so many very interesting books that I have enjoyed actually sometimes more with the narrated version, because there's just something about the voices of the narrators that has captured me. And so I'm going to have several narrators on. They're going to be coming on. They will read passages from the books, and they will talk about how they prepare to do a narration. And any of you authors who have your books out there, you have to seriously think about getting them done in audible versions, because it is a growing market. So many people do love to listen to books. Just last week, I had Laura Resnick on, and I just ordered the audible version of her books because I love her books. Absolutely. I read The Doppelganger first. That's the one that I recommend everybody start with. It is so funny. It is one of the few books that I am sitting there actually laughing out loud. And so I hope that you will all check out Laura Resnick's books too. And meanwhile, I just want to tell you all, remember, don't let anyone steal your joy. Treasure it and share it. And say something nice to somebody. And I'm going to say something nice to Big Ed in the control room. Thank you, Big Ed. And he's saluting me, and I'm saluting him. Bye-bye for now, everybody. Have a great weekend. It's going to be lovely weather. Bye-bye.